it feels like we have lived our lives for the last month, or maybe even longer, at this intersection of the coronavirus and the presidential election. You know, right now, President Trump has failed to concede in that election and is fighting in the courts, even as we've seen a second outbreak of the virus in his administration and an explosion of 1 million new coronavirus cases in the U.S. in a single week. So as we've done talking and learning about those subjects, living at that intersection, we here at Radio Boston have come up with a whole bunch of legal questions we want to ask on both subjects. And the good news is we have experts with us today who are going to answer them and who are going to take your calls. And I got to tell you, you might be able to hear it in my voice, my inner wonk is kind of excited about this. I think this is going to be fascinating. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have short conversations with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner on the legal questions raised post-election and Yale law professor John Fabian Witt on the pandemic. And then the two have agreed to stay on together and we're going to take some of your calls. So start thinking ahead. What legal questions do you have, let's say, about where the election stands, how the Trump administration is pursuing it in the courts? Or maybe it's on mask usage or a governor's right to tell people to stay home or a state's ability to shut down businesses. We're going to take those questions at 1-800-423-8255. We'll do that toward the end of the hour. Right now, we're going to welcome back Judge Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, I have been looking forward to a chance to talk to you about some of this stuff. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Okay, so do you see, let's just start with the Trump legal strategy. Do you see one? Is there a focused legal strategy? We've got dozens of lawsuits. The administration has filed. Some have been thrown out. Some are still sort of being litigated. Doesn't seem, according to observers, that any of them are likely to be able to change the results of the election. So what's going on?
Right. I mean, this is not Bush v. Gore, which involved a very narrow margin, 500 some odd votes in one state, which could tip the election. There are numbers of states here. The margin is very substantial, and none of the legal arguments that they have made are sufficient to undo the ultimate conclusion, which is an electoral college victory for Biden. The only play that I can see, there are two plays. One is political and one is legal. The legal play, which I don't think would work from what we've seen now, is simply to delay and keep results up in the air by the deadline of December 8th, when electors are to be chosen to vote the following week, and that is somehow if these electors are not chosen, then depending upon the state, then the resolution will depend upon state government. And perhaps if state governments can't decide, ultimately the House of Representatives. So that's the only, the legal play is delay. The political accompaniment of that delay is delegitimizing the election, is the chaos of the transition. So you're doing that, if it succeeds, at a tremendous cost. Now, it's not likely to succeed. What's been clear about
what would succeed, though, in that case be? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I get it what you're saying on the first one. But causing chaos, what is success at the end of that?
I don't think any of them will work. But if the Trump administration were able to keep a state from certifying electors by December 8th, that could have consequences because it would then either disqualify that state's electors or it would force the issue into the resolution of the state legislatures where the Republicans have an upper hand. So there's a delay. Delay fits into a larger legal strategy. It hasn't been working because they have been batted down in every court in which they brought these challenges. So the courts have said, sorry, this is not good enough. Sorry, this isn't good enough. So even the delay strategy hasn't been working.
All right. So one question I do want to ask is a lot of states passed new voting laws this year, allowing for different kinds of voting, especially early voting or mail-in voting due to the pandemic. Is there something to be said for litigating those, getting that law settled so that we know going forward what could be done again that way in future elections?
Well, the problem is there's nothing to settle. There's nothing to settle there. I mean, there's always been absentee ballots based on a particular excuse. There's always been overseas ballots from the military. What legislatures have done, and in some situations the executive has said, well, given the pandemic, let's have no excuse early voting, essentially, and no excuse absentee ballots. I don't see any meaningful legal challenge to that approach. And you're quite right, it would only be wiping out that approach that would have any impact on the election. This or that vote counting, this mistake is not sufficient. If they want to wipe out all the absentee ballots or all the early voting, that's a different issue. But I don't see a legal theory that would do that, or indeed should do that, right? The notion that we wouldn't want to maximize voting in a democracy is extraordinary to me. So I don't think that this would succeed.
Okay, Judge Gertner, thank you. I'm going to ask you, and I appreciate that you've agreed to sit tight, because I want to bring our other voice in. I want to remind callers we're going to take your legal calls, both on the pandemic and on the election, at 1-800-423-8255. So, Judge Gertner, while you listen, I'm going to turn now to Professor John Fabian Witt, who is a professor of law and history at Yale University. He's the author of a new book, American Contagions, Epidemics, and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. I was fascinated when I read the book to realize that historically Massachusetts has had a lot to do with the law and public health policy around pandemics. So, Professor Witt, let me welcome you as well to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So one of the things that was fascinating to me about the book is it gave people a way to think about and sort of frame out in their own heads what pandemic law is and how it works. So a key principle is that you write about are these two overarching legal strategies in the law for combating epidemics, and they are quarantinist and sanitationist. I know this sounds theoretical, but I think our listeners will really benefit. Explain what those are.
Sure. We have a long history of struggling with pandemics. You know, we're back to the 19th century in some ways. We don't remember in our lifetimes an epidemic or pandemic like this, but humanity's had plenty of them, and the United States has struggled with them too. So the quarantinist strategy is a strategy that tries to control bodies. It's been associated with authoritarian governments in the past, and the sanitationist strategy is a liberal or progressive strategy that tries to attend to environments and lift people up and improve living conditions in order to improve health.
All right. And we see essentially bucking today of various strategies states have taken, including the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Those strategies represent some quarantinist tactics and some sanitationist tactics. Is that fair?
For sure. So the United States has a mixed tradition. Probably every country has a mixed tradition in some respects. And we've seen both these kinds of measures put in place. We've seen efforts to have things called quarantines. That's quarantinist. On the other hand, we've had efforts to use things like masking rules or social distancing that are rearranging the landscape, the social landscape, in order to improve public health in the near term.
So we've heard a lot of pushback in this pandemic, Professor Witt, that the government is using its essentially coercive powers to overreach, imposing too much. I was struck in your book by the number of cases, including in Massachusetts, where governments historically have taken sweeping approaches, from mandating vaccines to mask mandates, et cetera, sweeping approaches in the past. So what about that?
Well, I think the power to reorganize social life, to manage the risk of epidemics, goes all the way back to the founding of this country and before. And our ancestors wouldn't have been surprised at all by sweeping efforts to rearrange social life, business closures, the permanent ending of businesses in certain areas. Big cities used to have pigs running through them. They used to have carcass burning operations as horses were rendered into glue. All these things used to happen in big cities and don't anymore, and were banned in public health measures, mostly in the 19th and into the early 20th century. So big regulations and coercive regulations aren't new. They just seem new to us because we got familiar with a world that seemed to have beaten back pandemics.
So, I was really struck. There was a vaccine order that the city of Cambridge did at the turn of the last century. That went all the way to the Supreme Court in the early 1900s. It's a case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. Can you tell us the legacy of that case for us today?
Sure. This is probably the most important precedent at the U.S. Supreme Court on the upholding of state police powers. And in Jacobson against Massachusetts, a Cambridge pastor named Henning Jacobson refused vaccination under the Cambridge vaccination mandate, which didn't have an exception built into it for adults in Cambridge. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Justice John Marshall Harlan, upheld Cambridge's authority to mandate vaccinations for any resident. And that's really a basic charter of civilization. It allows us the freedom of living safely in a community in which viruses can do grave damage. So the court's decision in Jacobson is really vital for our safety and for our freedom.
All right, one more question to you, and then I'll bring Judge Gertner back in. We'll start taking calls. Your book is very clear that there historically, not just the quarantinist approach, also the sanitarian, I think I have that right, sorry, approach, sanitationist approach, but also especially the quarantinist approach has really been a way to disproportionately impact people of color, immigrants, quote unquote, unwanted populations. Tell us just briefly that legacy.
Well, here's the thing is that democracies need to have this power. But it's also extraordinarily dangerous, right? The power to reorganize social life and to manage ourselves for our own benefit comes with the power to do great harm. And so there's a long tradition of discriminations enacted by states and cities and the federal government in the pursuit of public health, you know, from yellow fever in the 1790s in Philadelphia, where African-Americans were disproportionately affected, to a smallpox epidemic that raced through the camps of freed enslaved people during the Civil War, all the way through into the 20th century. I mean, HIV/AIDS is a wonderful, terrible example of the ways in which discriminations are visible in moments of infectious disease in our own time. And that's been a long thread, and we've got to watch for that. This COVID-19 has produced terrible effects on, for example, the Black community, the Native American community, disproportionate effects. And so we're seeing some of the same thing again.
All right, let's bring Judge Gertner back in here. And the calls are pouring in. We've got tweets coming in on Twitter. So, Judge Gertner, thanks for waiting. I'm glad to put you with Professor Witt. I'm going to go straight to the phones, 800-423-8255. Let's get a call from Scott in Waltham.
Hi. So my question is, what legal challenges would President-elect Biden face if he were to try and enforce a nationwide mask mandate or a nationwide closure of indoor dining or gyms, or something like that?
Okay. And Professor Witt, let me have you start, and then Professor Gertner, you can add in. Gertner, you can add in.
I'll take a shot at that. You know, professors always want to be judges, so you've got it backwards that way. The federal government's authority under the Commerce Clause would instantly come into question if the Biden administration tried to do something through the Congress, for example. And limits on the Congress's Commerce Clause are increasingly tight over the last 25 years or so. And so there would be real limits there. The nationwide mask mandate looks likely to happen through a set of inducements to states to act, through a set of regulations for interstate commerce or for federal facilities. That would be an easier way to do it.
Judge Gertner, is there anything you want to add there?
Well, I think what we've seen is that public health issues are usually local issues, state legislatures, local county issues. The federal government has actually limited authority to deal with them directly as a direct order from the federal government. But Professor Witt is right. The federal government is essentially a huge has huge powers of inducement and can affect all sorts of policies at the state and local level through their powers of inducement, through what they fund, through what they encourage, through the bully pulpit. And in addition, the federal government also has the authority, this is on the issue of the vaccine, to deal with the avenues of commerce. In other words, through the Defense Production Act, can basically mobilize manufacturers to distribute in a particular way. But as Professor Witt says, it's not direct authority, but it certainly is some authority.
So there's a question I wanted to pose to both of you. I'm going to play you some sound. This is Justice Samuel Alito, who spoke at the Federalist Society last Thursday. Just for listeners, that's an organization of conservatives and libertarians that advocates for what's called the originalist interpretation of the Constitution. At the event, Justice Alito made some news for his comment that the pandemic has resulted in, quote, unimaginable, end quote, restrictions on individual liberty. So here's the sound.
I'm not saying anything about the legality of COVID restrictions, nor am I saying anything about whether any of these restrictions represent good public policy. I'm a judge, not a policymaker. All that I'm saying is this, and I think it is an indisputable statement of fact. We have never before seen restrictions as severe, extensive, and prolonged as those experienced for most of 2020.
So here's what I want to do. Professor Witt, first I'm going to ask you if that's true. And then Judge Gertner, I'm going to ask you as a judge to remark on the fact that Justice Samuel Alito said that and in the environment in which he did it. So Professor Witt, is it true?
Not unprecedented. It's only the historical amnesia of our apparent defeat of infectious disease that could even let us think that. The basic organization of our cities, of our towns, has been remade over the course of two centuries to reflect the problem of infectious diseases. So lots of regulation, just so deeply embedded we don't even see it anymore.
And Judge Gertner, remark on the fact that the controversy is, in fact, a part that this was a sitting Supreme Court justice making these kinds of comments in a political venue.
These comments were extraordinary. It was, a grievance speech, which could have been made by President Trump. What he said was he, first of all, criticized decisions that had been issued by the Supreme Court, by the then majority of the Supreme Court before Justice Ginsburg died, affirming local government regulations controlling the pandemic. So he was in the minority in those cases, and he was criticizing those, which is already extraordinary. You're not criticizing 200-year precedent, you're criticizing what happened effectively, within the past month. And it wouldn't be so bad, except that these are precedents that are going to recur. In other words, these are issues that are going to recur. There's a case coming up through New York, through the Archdiocese, challenging restrictions on churches and synagogues, I think limiting the numbers of people that can gather to 10 or 15. And there's a court challenge that went up to the federal courts. So he's not just criticizing recent precedent before he effectively had a majority on the court, but he's clearly indicating the position that he's going to take with respect to precedent the next day. And he's doing it in the context of an organization, which while the organization says it's not an advocacy organization, candidly, in my view, that's a ruse. This is an organization that, while it doesn't sign on to briefs, sponsors and works with donors who are themselves filing amicus briefs on issues that the organization approves of, which is anti-regulation, anti-union, anti-environment. And this is also the organization, I might add, to whom Trump has outsourced his complete judicial selection. This is the Federalist Society. It's completely outsourced to the Federalist Society. So he's giving a partisan speech to partisan actors.
Okay, shifting gears, Professor Witt, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know, does the government have the ability to legally force target populations to take a vaccine? So a certain population that might be specifically vulnerable, for example, can the government legally force a population to take a vaccine?
Well, Jacobson against Massachusetts suggests the answer to that is yes. The Justice Harlan's opinion is careful to try to reserve a place for courts to step in if there was something arbitrary or capricious or especially cruel about such an order. But Jacobson against Massachusetts stands for the idea that if a vaccine is necessary to keep a community safe, a community is allowed to, through its elected representatives, put that kind of a program in place. Justice Alito cast some doubt on Jacobson against Massachusetts in that speech. It was really incredibly far-reaching. And so so whether Jacobson would hold up today is an open question. Strikes me as indispensable, although, of course, dangerous and important to be done right.
Okay, we've got a call for Judge Gertner. Melissa's on the line from Wrentham. Melissa, briefly.
Yes, I'm stymied by the President Trump's continued efforts to hold back the results of the election, because my understanding is that there is no legal requirement in the Constitution or otherwise that the sitting president, the loser, concede at all. It's become a custom, if I read correctly. So how is he holding everything up? And the committee that releases, or the department that releases transition funds, why are they waiting for him? They don't need to wait for him. So I'm really stuck about how this goes on.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
Judge Gertner.
There's no requirement that he concede. And once again, we are in the area of norms and habits and practices rather than in the area of statutes and constitutional issues. So there is no justification for the head of GSA or the person in charge of transition in GSA to, there's no requirement that she wait for a formal concession from her boss. But she is a political appointee, and de facto she is waiting for him to give her the signal. I suppose Biden could go into court and direct the GSA to do that. Again, we're in the area of norms. Nobody's ever done this before. And it may well be that the formal transition order would have to wait for the formal election in the Electoral College, which would be a disaster because of the emergency nature of COVID and other issues that are coming before the court. But this is another example of Trump simply not following the usual practices of other presidents, no matter who the party, no matter which party was involved. And we never wrote this stuff down because we didn't have to. And perhaps one of the first things that the new administration is going to have to do is to start seeking legislation to make concrete what otherwise has just been a matter of practice.
Just very briefly, Professor Witt, 10-second answer. Do you expect to see cases coming to the Supreme Court over measures that are being taken in this pandemic?
Well, we've already seen some orders on the court's shadow docket. So, yes, I think we'll see that. In 1918, the epidemic ended before that could really happen. Maybe we'll see that again this time.
Okay, that is Professor John Fabian Witt, professor of law and history at Yale University, author of the new book, American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19, and Judge Nancy Gertner, a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. This was a hoot. I learned a lot. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.